day, Gwinnett said. Margaret stirred the instant coffee in her cup. Annabelle and Gwinnett were silent. The only sound came from a distant chorus of gulls, egrets, and red-winged blackbirds. There were 43 men in the crew, Margaret said. 29 survived. My father was not among them. She lowered herself to sit cross-legged on the ground. There were 4 Zeppelins in the U.S. around that time, Gwinnett recalled. 3 were made by the Americans. They all crashed. 1 was made by the Germans. It didn't. He took a swig from his flask. Our great, infallible capitalist system at work. Margaret didn't know how to take his remarks. She looked at Annabelle, who was nodding in agreement. I'll be right back, Annabelle said, suddenly standing. She went to her tent, reached in, grabbed a roll of toilet paper, and headed to a nearby grove. So, Margaret, Gwinnett said, moving so close to her that their knees were nearly touching. She looked at him expectantly. I noticed that you threw up this morning. Twice. Margaret grimaced. She knew what was coming. When were you going to tell me you're pregnant? He asked. Damn it, Margaret thought. She'd really counted on more time to keep the news to herself. Well, I figured I could keep participating in the fieldwork until I had to stop, she said. I was going to tell you, I just didn't know exactly how, and honestly, I was hoping to get away with not being treated differently for as long as I could. It's fine, Gwinnett said. I'm sure neither Annabelle nor any of the others picked up on it. I would have noticed sooner or later. I'm a connoisseur of the female form, especially yours. He held up the flask as a toast and took another swig. She had been ignoring men's inappropriate comments since she was 12, but Margaret felt differently about Gwinnett's come-on. In some small corner of her mind, she wanted him to find her appealing. Her heart began beating more quickly. She thought of a hummingbird. Well, to be perfectly candid, Charlie and I didn't plan this, she said, motioning vaguely toward her womb. Gwinnett smiled. You know how it happens, though, right? Margaret laughed. Yes, I understand the basic cause and effect. He turned away and muttered something. The cadence made her think it was, I'll bet you do, but she tried to ignore it. She liked Gwinnett. They worked well together, and he was a respected figure in their field. She hoped this baby and this conversation wouldn't change things between them. They'd first met at the 1943 Zoological Association of America annual summer conference at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, where Gwinnett, a renowned equus expert, taught. Margaret, then about to begin her junior year at Barnard, ate lunch every day with the other women in attendance. There were 6 of them at a conference with 84 participants. Most of the men ignored them, but Gwinnett pulled up a chair and talked to all of them about what areas of the field they were most interested in, as well as his concerns about the difficulties the London Zoo was having during the war. Learning that she was hoping to write her senior thesis focused on the mysterious wild ponies of Nanticoke and Susquehannock Islands, he invited her to keep in touch. Margaret suspected it was a casual remark, but she was still thrilled to be noticed by a scholar she'd long admired, and, she had to admit, by someone so undeniably handsome. She had missed the conference in 1945 when Charlie finally returned from war and he and Margaret were engaged and married in haste. At the 1946 conference Margaret had attended at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, Gwinnett shook her right hand hello and simultaneously grabbed her left hand, admiring the wedding band and making a regretful tsk sound. Over the course of the weekend, they shared an obvious chemistry as well as a few meals together, but Gwinnett was careful not to openly flirt, and Margaret, very much a blissful newlywed in all other respects, worked hard to tamp down the attraction she felt toward him, going so far as to look in the hotel mirror one morning and say sternly and dramatically to herself, as if she were in a Cary Grant screwball comedy, "You are a married woman, Mrs. Martyr." She and Gwinnett attended panels and lectures together, and she diligently kept every conversation completely appropriate, as if Charlie were there with them. Gwinnett followed her lead. To end one particularly loaded silence after her hand accidentally grazed his, he clumsily launched into the details of an article he'd read about the recent discovery of echolocation by bats. She was relieved when the conference was over, and they shared a friendly, brief farewell with vague promises to keep in touch, just like every other casual academic acquaintance. And then, that was it. Margaret had wondered if their friendship would blossom, carefully, chastely, with each successive encounter. 20 years her senior, he was full of experience and brilliance, But Gwinnett didn't show up at the 1947 or 1948 conference. He was there in 1949, but he kept a respectful distance, and the relationship continued that way until just a few months ago, 2 days after Charlie had accepted Governor Dewey's offer to serve out the remainder of Congressman Van Wagenen's term. Out of the blue, on a December day, a letter had arrived, special delivery from Gwinnett, informing Margaret that he had received a grant to study the ponies that had been their shared interest. He was putting together a small team to conduct field research throughout the year, starting in January, and there was a role and a tent for her if she so desired. Suddenly, moving to Washington, D.C., a mere 2 or so hours away from the islands, offered her more than just the opportunity to be a congressional spouse. And now, here they were. "May I ask you a personal question, Mags?" he said. "And I'm sorry for flirting. I'll calm it down. I'm just tired and the whiskey isn't helping."
"Sure."
"Have you been trying to have a baby all this time and it's only now happening?"
"Because I'm a bit old, you mean?"
"You're a perfectly healthy specimen. It's just that I'm used to observing an earlier breeding process." He smiled.
"Well, we just kept putting it off," she confessed.
"Charlie and I were working on his book, and..."
"You worked on Sons of Liberty?"
"Yes, as an editor. And I helped organize his research. And we both just got caught up in the world of academia and scholarship. For a time, I was working with the City Parks Department to catalog every wild animal in Manhattan."
"Including the alligators in the sewer?"
She grinned. "No alligators, sadly. I had to debunk that urban myth in the summer of 1950. No, no alligators, but quite a few sewer rats and even some sad colonies of people under there."
"Well, I'm crushed," Gwinnett said. "You're very special. We'll miss you when you have to leave."
Margaret was irritated. She was having a baby, not retiring, and she was certainly not ready to mourn for her career. She started to assure him of this when something in the distance caught her eye.
"Look,"
she said, pointing toward the western horizon. Gwinnett turned to see a pony. Margaret picked herself up off the ground and slowly, quietly, deliberately began heading toward the pony, slogging through the wet marsh, the weeds squishing beneath her feet. In her hurry, she accidentally dropped her binoculars into the swamp, but she was too preoccupied to stop to retrieve them. Gwinnett followed her. Margaret was 20 feet away when the pony turned and, it seemed to Margaret, looked directly into her eyes. It was Teardrop.
"Hi there, beauty," Margaret said, approaching prudently.
The pony snorted and looked down, splashing his forelegs in the marshy shallows. Margaret took another cautious step forward, one hand outstretched, barely able to breathe. Very few people ever got this close to one of these ponies. For all she knew, she was the first human he'd ever encountered. She was desperate to touch him, to pat the soft side of his stocky neck. Again he looked at her, and she felt a shudder of connection. Gwinnett stood behind her, silently, as she slowly moved toward Teardrop, murmuring in low tones she hoped would reassure him, never taking her gaze from his. Her heart was pounding. Her mouth was dry. She reached the beast and slowly put her hand on his forehead, then softly patted him down to his muzzle. He leaned into her and closed his eyes. And then, abruptly, Teardrop tossed his head and pawed the water before turning and galloping into the distance. Margaret stood watching him, trying to understand what had just happened. Gwinnett's voice broke the spell.
"Wow," said Gwinnett, coming up to stand next to her. "That was incredible."
Margaret nodded mutely.
"We should go back to camp and write up our notes. Annabelle will be jealous when she hears how close you got."
Margaret felt a sharp pang of loneliness. The person she most wanted to tell was Charlie, who was 100 miles away. She missed him deeply. She looked one last time at the spot where Teardrop had just stood, then turned and followed Gwinnett back to see if she could find her binoculars in the swamp. Chapter 8. Saturday, January 23rd, 1954. Georgetown, Washington, D.C. Margaret had been home from Nanticoke Island for only an hour when, still unshowered and exhausted, she answered the townhouse doorbell and was greeted by a pretty, college-age woman holding Charlie's dry-cleaned tuxedo.
"Hello, Mrs. Martyr. I'm Cheryl Ann Bernstein, the congressman's intern."
Miss Leopold asked me to deliver this. I hope I'm not intruding.
She handed over the garment and smiled so brightly Margaret almost wanted to shield her eyes.
Thank you, she said. I hope you and the congressman have a good weekend.
The intern was halfway down the townhouse steps when she turned around.
Oh, Mrs. Martyr, she cried. Please tell the congressman I made some progress on my homework assignment.
She smiled yet again and then bounced away, a vision of perky youth that made Margaret feel ancient. Charlie was tucked away in his first-floor study, surrounded by tall stacks of thick reference books.
Some Debbie Reynolds look-alike just dropped this off, she said,
hanging the tuxedo on the doorknob.
Oh, crud, Charlie said. I forgot to tell you, I have to go to a dinner this evening. The Alfalfa Club. Alfalfa like from the Little Rascals?
No, alfalfa like the plant, he said distractedly, the roots of which will apparently do anything to find a drink. That's the conceit of the name, at any rate. Har har.
Yes, I get it, Charlie, Margaret said dryly. You're spending too much time educating infatuated interns, perhaps, assigning them homework.
Preoccupied by the book in his hand, Charlie raised an eyebrow.
What? Nothing. Anyway, I'm filthy and I need to shower.
She headed upstairs, and Charlie decided to let her comment dissolve in the ether, returning his attention to the Funk and Wagnalls New World Encyclopedia. He'd been looking for more information about Chairman Carlin when he stumbled on the entry for the University of Chicago. Recalling the odd note he'd found in his desk, he read more in hopes of learning what the school might have had to do with cereal grains or broadleaf crops. Messrs. Funk and Wagnalls offered no help. No matter. Charlie turned instead to entries on Kefauver and others whom he thought he might encounter that evening. The Alfalfa Club was among the most elite social organizations in Washington, D.C., its membership consisting of 200 business leaders, politicians, sometimes even presidents. Charlie's invitation was obviously an afterthought, but that didn't diminish his anticipation. Yesterday, he had been having lunch in the private Senate dining room with Senator Margaret Chase Smith, Republican of Maine, when Kefauver stopped by their table. "I see you've met the conscience of the Republican Party," Kefauver said playfully, tilting his head in Smith's direction. It had been 4 years since Joe McCarthy saw Margaret Smith on the Senate subway and told her she looked very serious.
"Are you going to make a speech?" he asked.
"Yes," she responded, "and you will not like it."
Smith's declaration of conscience, delivered on the Senate floor, derided McCarthy's four horsemen of calumny: fear, ignorance, bigotry, and smear. She and Kefauver were thus allies against McCarthy, whose demagogic mudslinging campaign against anyone to the left of Generalissimo Francisco Franco had been roiling the Republic for too long. McCarthy's opponents were beginning to gain ground, but Tail Gunner Joe, as he'd been nicknamed by someone, perhaps McCarthy himself, was winning the war of attrition. His adversaries were exhausted. He remained popular with a strong segment of the public, whose support of him seemed impervious to obvious moments of indecency and prevarication. Those who feared McCarthy might never actually go away and that the fever of McCarthyism might never break were growing despondent. Kefauver handed Charlie a folded over New York Times and tapped a finger on a page 9 story. Rival for Senate assails Kefauver. Sutton, House member, runs in the Tennessee primary as ultra-conservative. Charlie had read the story about Congressman Pat Sutton, one of his new poker buddies. Sutton was quoted saying he liked Kefauver personally, that they had visited each other's homes, but he didn't like the senior senator's record, that he, quote, has consistently voted as a left-winger against the loyalty oath in the government, and he has voted against wiretapping to catch the Reds.
Do you know this jackanapes, Charlie? Kefauver asked.
It's not enough that the Republicans in Knoxville have all but issued a hit on me this year. Not enough that the newspapers are all controlled by Boss Crump's corrupt machine. Now this little blunderbuss with whom I've broken bread is accusing me of being a commie simp.
Charlie shifted in his seat.
Sutton was a former Navy lieutenant whose many medals included the Distinguished Service Cross and the Silver Star with oak leaf clusters. A demolitions expert, he was a bona fide war hero and a fair poker player whose tell was boasting about his hand. That meant his cards were garbage. Charlie liked him.
I don't know him well, sir, Charlie said. He's in my poker group along with all the other veterans. He held his tongue and stole a look at Smith, whose lips were pursed and whose eyes were distant. She seemed to be used to other senators talking as if she weren't there.
They'll come at me as a Negro lover, for one, same way Russell did in Florida back in 52, Kefauver said. Sutton is already pursuing the Dixiecrats, and goddamn Earl Warren's Supreme Court is going to vote to desegregate schools any minute, which the good people of Tennessee are decidedly not prepared for. And as if that weren't enough, a guy with a chest full of medals is coming into the Democratic primary and is damn sure going to ask why I didn't fight in the war. Though a businessman I know told me that a guy with that many medals is either reckless or foolish.
Do you want me to say something to him about tempering his rhetoric, sir? Charlie asked. And, if I may, I don't know that I would repeat that reckless or foolish line on the stump.
No, of course not, Kefauver said.
He looked at his young protege.
Say, Charlie, what are you doing tomorrow night? I have an extra ticket to the Alfalfa Club dinner.
Charlie hesitated. Margaret was due home tomorrow, and he was longing to see her. Kefauver pressed him.
It will be a room full of people you need to know better, Charlie.
Charlie knew this would be an opportunity to lobby against Goodstone, and he also had to admit that he'd long been curious about the club.
I'd be glad to join you, sir.
Thank you.
Get some rest, the senator said. It can be a wild night. Wives and girlfriends are not invited.
As Kefauver walked away, Charlie glanced sympathetically at the 14-year congressional veteran in the pearls and cashmere sweater across the table, who had sat silently with a bemused smile throughout the exchange.
Don't you worry about it any, Congressman, Smith said, dipping her spoon into a bowl of New England clam chowder. I'm used to it.
The next night, as Charlie entered the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel to attend the dinner, he felt as dashing as the main character in the spy novel he'd read on summer vacation. An agent who played high-stakes baccarat in northern France, posing as a rich Jamaican playboy. Ushered into the grand ballroom where multiple bartenders were stationed like sentries, Charlie immediately ran into Kefauver as he was delivering what appeared to be a successful punchline to Robert Hendrickson, the Republican from New Jersey with whom Kefauver was working on the comic book hearings. Charlie waited politely for their laughter to fade. Kefauver turned to him with a jovial grin.
Charlie, great to see you, he said, switching his Scotch rocks into his left hand and extending his right.
Thank you so much for having me, Charlie said. I must confess I know nothing about the Alfalfas except why you call yourselves that.
Not much to tell, Kefauver assured him. Just another one of these ridiculous clubs. D.C. is full of them, and some are more nefarious than others. This dinner is pretty much the club's raison d'etre. It all started as a way to honor the birthday of Robert E. Lee.
We Yankees always find it curious how much love is continually bestowed upon the losers of that conflict, said Hendrickson, whom Kefauver then proceeded to jokingly elbow.
Washington seems to have a lot of these clubs, Charlie added. Alfalfa, Gridiron.
Oh, these aren't the ones that matter, Kefauver said. These are just excuses for frivolity. The clubs to keep an eye on are the ones whose memberships are secret, the ones we only hear whispers about. The John Birch Society, the Southern Heritage Alliance, the Sons of Gettysburg, something called Hellfire.
Charlie looked at Kefauver curiously. There was a Hellfire Club in England in the 1700s.
Is that right? The senator responded flatly, seemingly uninterested.
Oh, Estes! Those are just Beltway rumors, Hendrickson said, just like the Loch Ness Monster or the Jersey Devil. We hear about them, but no one has ever really seen them.
An athletic older man with a strong jaw and a full head of gray hair walked by.
Is that?
Charlie asked.
Yes, that's Gene Tunney, Kefauver said.
Gene!
The senator called to the former heavyweight champion, who turned his head, smiled, and held up his fists as if posing for a promotional boxing photo.
Pavlovian, observed Charlie.
Gene's one of our inductees this evening, Hendrickson said.
He pointed out others in the crowd as he named them.
In addition to Gene, we're honoring Arthur Kroc from the Times, the House Majority Leader, plus General Bradley and, who is it? Oh yes, General Doolittle.
Not necessarily in that order, I hope, Charlie joked. He was a great admirer of Bradley, who'd commanded U.S. forces in Europe during World War II. And of course, the entire nation was proud of Medal of Honor recipient Jimmy Doolittle, who had personally led a dangerous mission into Japan. Kefauver suddenly looked serious. He glanced at Hendrickson, who took the hint, and announced that he needed to go find a refill.
"Charlie," he said, "I got an earful from Chairman Carlin at the members' meeting earlier tonight. He's heard that you're organizing your fellow veterans against this Goodstone appropriation, and he is not happy."
"Not really organizing, per se," Charlie said. "Just some conversations over poker. This is getting blown out of proportion."
"Welcome to Washington," Kefauver said. "Listen, you need to fix this. You're about to get gelded, son."
Charlie was briefly spared by a baritone shout.
"Estes!"
Barreling toward them was an older man smoking a cigar and holding a martini glass. He looked like an editorial cartoon of a robber baron. Deeply tanned, bald pate, V-shaped scowl, enormous belly.
"Good to see you, Connie," Kefauver said. "Charlie, you know Conrad Hilton."
"I know of him, of course," said Charlie. "Pleasure to meet you, sir."
"And this is Davis LaMontagne," Hilton said, introducing the younger man to his right. "He's my guest, a rising star at Janus Electronics. Do you know of them? Very exciting young company specializing in electronics and technology for the Cold War era."
"Oh, I just handle legal and lobbying in a little office here," LaMontagne said, shrugging off the compliment with the assurance of someone accustomed to being reminded of his own accomplishments. "How do you do?"
LaMontagne was movie star handsome, maybe 40, with slicked back dark hair. He held the scotch on the rocks and was wearing a smoky cologne. Charlie thought he recognized the scent. Cuir de Russie. The same pricey cologne worn by one of his more annoying trust fund students at Columbia, a boy who'd asked a Russian history professor if the scent truly captured the rich aromas of Russian leather. LaMontagne extended a hand toward Charlie without waiting for an introduction.
"Congressman Charlie Marder from New York," he said. "You're my congressman. In fact, Manhattan is my official residence."
"Mine too," said Hilton.
Hilton had a type of handshake favored by a particular sort of domineering male. He clasped Charlie's hand in a vice-like grip and tried to jerk him forward. There had been a guy in basic training who'd pulled the same America's number one He-Man nonsense, so Charlie knew to immediately freeze his arm and hold his ground. Hilton gave him a brief appraising glance in return.
"Nice to meet you," Charlie said, feeling a bit like a teenager being introduced to his father's friends. Hilton so full of wealthy bluster, and LaMontagne so polished and smooth.
"Gentlemen, I'm going to need your help with something," Hilton said. "Especially yours, Senator."
"Of course," said Kefauver. "What is it?"
There was a pause during which Charlie realized that, again like a teenager, his company was not required. He tilted an imaginary glass toward his mouth, to the evident relief of his companions, and started wandering through the crowd, searching for a destination. Fat men in tuxedos stood in a circle. Black waiters hustled out of the kitchen holding trays of Swedish meatballs, shrimp boats, anchovies soaked in wine. Charlie caught snatches of conversations.
"So why is it exactly that McCarthy isn't married?"
"Thank God we have Nasser. He just locked up 300 of those fanatics."
"Wife is fine. Mistress better. A Frenchman, Cousteau, I think, exploring a sunken ship off Marseille. Great television."
"Still talking about the goddamn war. It was almost a decade ago."
"Well, she's a nuclear sub, so she can stay out there forever."
"Is he smart? Smart enough to be dangerous."
"Yeah, yeah, we're the problem. Us and Wall Street. Everyone's to blame but the voters."
Standing with Lyndon Johnson against a wall, Bob Kennedy swiped his hair off his forehead and looked around the room, seemingly searching for an escape. Chairman Carlin was horsing around with Gene Tunney, pretending to box with him while a photographer captured the moment for posterity.
"Choose your poison," said a bartender after Charlie finally settled on a bar, the one farthest from the masses.
"Have any hemlock?" Charlie asked. The bartender smiled and shook his head.
"Two vodkas, one glass, then," Charlie said.
"Rough day?"
Congressman Chris McLachlan appeared at his side.
"Just thirsty," Charlie held up his glass.
"Good to see you, Mac, even if you did clean my clock at poker."
McLachlan smiled and raised his glass.
"May you be in heaven half an hour afore the devil knows you're dead."
He took a healthy swallow from a gin and tonic.
Did you see Carlin? Charlie asked.
The old ham can't resist a chance to pose for the cameras.
Well, that old ham knows about my suggestion that the veterans stick together and kill the Goodstone earmark, Charlie said. Kefauver told me he's furious.
McLachlan sipped his drink, then exhaled.
Sweet baby Moses, we didn't even decide to carry out that play.
People in this town can't keep their mouths shut.
Keep fighting the good fight, McLachlan said. You're following the trail Van Wagenen blazed.
If I'm doing that, it's not on purpose, Charlie said. I don't know much about him, just that he was an aide on the Truman Committee and helped him take on Wright Aeronautical.
Yeah, the bastards. Shit engines, faked inspections, dead American pilots.
He paused and motioned to the bartender for a refill.
That's what started him on his mission.
Yeah, I remember headlines about Van Wagenen challenging various corporations, malfeasance and such.
When he got going, he was like a dog with a goddamn bone, McLachlan said.
The din of the all-male crowd, deep, baritone crescendos of laughter and shouts, highlighted the silence between Charlie and McLachlan.
He made a lot of enemies, McLachlan noted.
McLachlan turned to get a better view of the crowd and those around him, then leaned closer to Charlie.
This post-war economic boom, the long boom they're calling it, it's wonderful for our standing in the world and for our constituent standard of living, but there's an accompanying madness, a recklessness. So much money being made, like nothing this country has ever seen before, and here in Washington, there are a lot of people working to stop anyone from even asking questions about what is sometimes a clear disregard for our own people.
Van Wagenen may have been a victim.
McLachlan stopped himself as Chairman Carlin suddenly stepped into his line of sight, perhaps 30 feet away.
Oh boy, Charlie said, as the chairman started walking toward him, with the determination of a crocodile moving in on an oblivious gazelle.
Don't forget your oath, McLachlan said under his breath, protecting America from enemies foreign and domestic. Goodstone counts.
He patted Charlie's shoulder and vanished into the crowd.
Charlie steeled himself, remembering that he had been through tougher stuff than the ire of a powerful congressman. He leaned into the encounter, throwing his handshake at the chairman like a Robin Roberts fastball, and deploying every available ounce of charisma he had as aggressively as he could. "Chairman Carlin, I owe you an apology," Charlie said, looking into Carlin's roomy eyes, his irises the color of swamp algae. "I should never have spoken up at the committee markup, nor should I have engaged in any small talk about Goodstone with my fellow veterans. Of the former, I can only tell you that I am young and inexperienced, in other words, dumb. Of the latter, well, sir, you served in the Great War, and I'm certain you know what it's like when veterans get around drink."
Charlie had read that morning that Carlin had served as a U.S. Army officer from 1917 to 1919, though he had never left the continental United States, having worked in the Pentagon procurement office. Still, service was service.
"Why, Charlie," said Carlin, clearly taken aback after arriving loaded for bear, "that's mighty white of you."
"With your permission, sir, I would beg a moment of your time to try to explain myself." Carlin smiled. Charlie's military deference seemed familiar to him, perhaps a nostalgic echo from his service at the Pentagon.
"Permission granted."
So Charlie told a short version of the recapture of the town of Limon, the French family, the stash of poison gas hidden in the barn, the errant mortar, the shoddy Goodstone gas masks, the deaths of Private First Class Rodriguez, and the French father and his two small children. Carlin listened impassively.
"So I got emotional, I suppose," Charlie said. "I'm sorry about how I handled this, and the last thing I want to do is be disrespectful. I have great admiration for you."
Carlin paused, then said, "Well, thank you, Charlie. We will figure this out." He put a paternal arm around Charlie's shoulders. He reeked of aqua velva and anchovies.
"A lot of things can happen in this town when people work together. I'm glad we had this talk."
Relieved to see Carlin walk away, but also slightly disgusted by his own obsequiousness, even though it was in the service of a larger goal, Charlie took a deep breath.
"Gentlemen, gentlemen, please take your seats," shouted Senator Harry Byrd, Democrat of Virginia, into the microphone.
Across the room, Kefauver was waving him toward their long table, and soon Charlie found himself seated between the senator and LaMontagne, and across from Conrad Hilton.
"What are we to expect tonight?" LaMontagne asked Charlie,
I'm a virgin here.
I am too, Charlie said. I believe it's a mock political convention. They nominate a faux presidential candidate and he gives a silly speech. From the right side of the stage, the Marine Corps band began playing Hail to the Chief, and the 500 or so attendees, Alfalfa Club members and guests, stood and applauded as President Eisenhower appeared on stage, beaming and waving. Some of the generals and admirals, wearing their dress uniforms, saluted as he approached the microphone.
At ease, dog faces, he said, prompting laughter from the crowd, along with the clinking of glass and ice cubes.
Eisenhower took his seat at one of the long tables, and Byrd resumed speaking, working through a number of self-congratulatory references to the club and the attendees. Charlie was lost in thoughts of his conversations with McLachlan and Carlin. Was the Goodstone money going to be killed? He wasn't sure what Carlin had meant when he said they would figure it all out.
This is exactly what I hate about coming down here to D.C. for these rubber chicken affairs, LaMontagne whispered, his breath warm and minty. A bunch of old guys bawling each other off and a room of brown nosers laughing like their next performance review depended on it.
Charlie noted the contrast between LaMontagne's smooth, polished demeanor when they'd met earlier and his one of the boys' crudeness now that he was in different company. Social chameleons were a source of fascination to him. He envied their ability to fit into any situation, a talent he lacked. He'd felt its absence acutely since arriving in the Capitol. On stage, Byrd was nominating for President Henry Cabot Lodge, Jr., the Eisenhower administration's ambassador to the United Nations. Lodge, a Republican, had been the U.S. Senator from Massachusetts until Jack Kennedy defeated him 2 years before.
Did you know Kennedy's grandfather lost a race to Lodge's father for the same Senate seat? Charlie whispered to LaMontagne. The very same one, in 1916.
Jack's around here somewhere. I saw him hobble in earlier, LaMontagne said. I'm hearing a lot of chatter about him making a play for VP in 56. Good thing we fought that war against royalty.
My overprivileged friends, Lodge began, prompting disproportionate howls of laughter.
What's the ratio going to be tonight of laughter to quality of joke? LaMontagne quietly asked.
20-1, I'd wager, Charlie said. He was enjoying LaMontagne's company, as well as the liberal supply of cocktails.
Kefauver, sitting to Charlie's left, shot Charlie a look that seemed to suggest that he and his new friend needed to pipe down.
Once I am elected, Lodge said grandly, I can guarantee you one thing. It will always look as though big things are happening. Maybe they won't be happening, but it will look that way.
Riotous laughter.
I may be doing nothing to stop the war in Korea, or nothing to balance the budget, or nothing to solve anything. But there will be a lot of name-calling. There will be all sorts of headlines, Lodge pledged. The trivial will reach a new place in American politics. And believe me, when you consider the place it has had in previous administrations, that is no idle boast.
Hysterics in the crowd. Kefauver actually wiped tears from his eyes. LaMontagne slipped Charlie a business card.
I can only take so much of this, he whispered. Give me a call. Let's tell war stories.
He got up and then leaned in one more time.
Enjoy yourself if you can.
He swiftly exited the ballroom, as graceful and stealthy as a leopard. Charlie felt woozy from the booze and the bullshit and the conversational whiplash. He wanted desperately to talk to Margaret, but he'd never felt farther away from her. Chapter 9, Thursday, February 18th, 1954. Georgetown, Washington, D.C.
You're up early, said Margaret, not looking up from her book as Charlie walked into the kitchen.
I have meetings and an early committee vote, he replied. He yawned and removed the Maxwell House percolator from the cupboard. The defense spending bill, thankfully without any money going to Goodstone this time. In the 3 weeks since the Alfalfa Club dinner, Chairman Carlin had told Charlie that he would remove the earmark for Goodstone if Charlie would just drop the matter and entrust it to him. Sensing no other option, and disarmed by Carlin's responsiveness, he agreed and told his fellow veterans that all was well.
You've no doubt been up for hours already? He asked, reaching for the tin of coffee grounds in the cabinet.
She shrugged. The early pregnancy had meant not just morning sickness, but also insomnia. She'd been awake since before dawn, vaguely troubled and uneasy. A silence hung in the air, but it wasn't the normal one born of comfort. Since Margaret's return from Nanticoke Island and Charlie's official baptism in the D.C. swamp by the Alfalfas, she felt that they'd drifted apart a bit. She suspected the pregnancy was a likely culprit, or at least an accomplice. Every evening, when Charlie returned home from work or from one of the various fundraisers and social functions he had to attend, she was often sound asleep. But there were grievances, too, growing stronger and healthier. She felt exasperated and stretched thin, trying to work with the research team's notes and conclusions from their first outing to the Maryland Island. Plus, she was finishing up a paper for the Journal of Zoology comparing the health of giraffes at the Bronx Zoo with those at the Philadelphia Zoo, based on research she'd completed the previous November. Plus, unpacking their moving boxes and decorating their new townhouse. Plus, keeping a home for Charlie, who meanwhile was consumed with his new job. They were on completely different tracks and traveling in opposite directions. Margaret watched Charlie pour himself a cup of coffee from the percolator, surely their most useful wedding present, and she thought about the space that had grown between them. It didn't seem unbridgeable. She imagined Charlie as being like a beach ball in the surf that a sudden breeze had carried away from shore. Retrievable, but it would require effort. They had been married for almost 9 years now, so the notion that marriage was work was hardly revelatory, but she felt farther away from him than she had in years. Perhaps even since those early days, when the war was too much with him. She thought about their life in New York. Conversations had been lively and frequent, and they shared genuine interest in each other's lives and careers. She had loved to hear his stories about the ridiculous, vicious battles within the Columbia University faculty. His odd brush with intellectual celebrity visiting What's My Line and other shows to promote Sons of Liberty. The few memories that he was willing to share of his time in the Army. And he was as good a listener as he was a storyteller. She could lay out a knotty research problem or writing challenge, and he was eager to talk it through with her until she arrived at possible solutions. He was her sounding board for her frustrations with her mother and sister, and though Charlie never spoke an ill word about his parents, he laughed when she did. But somehow all that had changed a few weeks after their move. Beyond her unavailability after 7 p.m., she knew some blame lay with her, and her growing impatience with the political world he seemed to find increasingly seductive. Or, if not seductive, irresistible. Its rituals and caste systems were abhorrent to her, and sometimes she couldn't help reacting to Charlie's stories with eye rolls and crossed arms. She'd been bitterly disappointed in him when he told her he had backed off his behind-the-scenes campaign against Goodstone because the chairman had made a non-committal remark about taking care of matters. And the comic book hearing seemed like the height of nonsense to her. She'd given up pretending to understand why he was taking part. Margaret held her tongue as often as she could, but he made that difficult by confiding in her and telling her everything, about his moments of unctuousness with Kefauver and Carlin, about each of his compromises. Each instance of confessed deference became a presence in the house, an ugly piece of furniture they had to walk around. Charlie eventually stopped telling her about his day in anything but the broadest and most positive outlines, and she, in turn, felt less inclined to tell him about hers. She was sure that he resented her refusal to join him in his new world, but she just couldn't make herself comfortable in a place where compromise and obsequiousness were as much a part of the landscape as traffic circles and monuments to long-dead generals. Charlie sat down at the table with his coffee, picked up the Washington Times Herald and folded it lengthwise, as all New York subway commuters learned to do, no matter that he'd be leaving it behind to drive to work shortly. She felt a burst of affection for him suddenly, for his predictable habits. Now he was adding milk to his coffee, and as he reached for the small sugar bowl, she counted down silently, 3, 2, 1, until his daily utterance, "I forgot to get a spoon." He got up to retrieve one. He sat back down and looked at her. "What's that you're reading?" Being reminded of the book she was holding extinguished the tiny spark of fondness she'd been so happy to welcome just now. She found her bookmark, a faded National Park Service ribbon given to her by a park ranger that summer she spent in Maryland as a girl, and flipped back to an earlier page. "A load of manure," Margaret said. "See if you recognize it." A 6-year-old boy, an ardent comic book reader, fashioned for himself a cape and, quote, "jumped off the cliff to fly as his comic book heroes did. Seriously injured, he told his mother, 'Mama, I almost did fly.' A few days later, he died from the injuries he had received." She held up the book, Frederick Wortham's Seduction of the Innocent, which was to be published next month, and which was the basis for the special investigative hearing that Kefauver and Hendrickson hoped to hold in Charlie's district in April. "Have you actually read this, Charlie?" she asked.
No footnotes, no endnotes, no citations, nothing.
As academics, Charlie and Margaret had both developed healthy skepticism about anecdotes that proved too perfect. A rival of Charlie's on the Columbia University faculty had been ignominiously terminated when it became clear that he'd massaged details in his book about Joseph Stalin. It had caused something of a stir since the details that the professor had tweaked, and in at least two cases that he seemed to have created out of whole cloth, depicted Stalin's actions during the Great Purge in an even more horrific light. The professor, a conservative, claimed that the faculty was compromised and was treasonously trying to cover up for their comrade. Charlie agreed that the faculty was jam-packed with communists and socialists and liberals who didn't take the evils of communism seriously, but he happened to side with his pinko colleagues in this case when it came to academic standards. "I've read it," Charlie said, "and I agree with you." The book was filled with shoddy scholarship and twisted interpretations, a conclusion in search of evidence. Batman and Robin were, quote, like a wish dream of two homosexuals living together. Superman was a fascist. Wonder Woman, a lesbian dominatrix.
"And yet you're still actually participating in this hearing?" she asked. "Are you really helping them book the Foley Square courthouse?"
She shook her head in disbelief.
"I don't understand how you can be a part of any of this."
He mumbled something about needing to work with Congress in order to be able to do some larger good. But it didn't sound any more convincing than all the previous times he'd said it, and the look on his face told her the disappointment on her own devastated him. Charlie walked into his congressional office just before 8:30 and was surprised to find LaMontagne standing there, smoking a cigarette and examining the various pictures and framed political memorabilia on the wall. Leopold, who had followed Charlie into the office with her ubiquitous clipboard in hand, emitted a sharp gasp of surprise.
"How did you get in here?" she asked. "What the..."
"It's okay, Miss Leopold," Charlie said. "Davis LaMontagne, this is Miss Leopold, who runs my office." They exchanged terse pleasantries before Leopold, still clearly unhappy about the intrusion, left the two men alone. Since their first encounter at the Alfalfa Club, they'd run into each other several times, never making plans to get together, but often ending up in the same corner of a social event, swapping war stories and mocking the various displays before them. LaMontagne had advised Charlie to go along to get along, do what Kefauver and Carlin and others asked him to do. And it seemed to be working, with Kefauver singing his praises in an interview with the New York Herald Tribune and promising to give him a showy role during the comic book hearings. Charlie took off his suit jacket and loosened his Brooks Brothers tie while LaMontagne moved to the couch and held out his pack of cigarettes, offering one. Charlie nodded and LaMontagne tossed him the pack of Chesterfields. Charlie used his German lighter. LaMontagne gestured toward the lighter.
"Looks familiar," he said. "I got one, too. Plucked it off a dead Jerry. So listen. I'm here because I know something, and I thought you could maybe bring this information to the right people. But I need your discretion, of course."
"Of course." Charlie sat down behind his desk. "How can I help you?"
"A guy who used to work for us."
"At Janus Electronics?" LaMontagne nodded.
"A few years ago, we were told that he was a communist."
"In what way? Actively?"
"Exactly. What way?" LaMontagne said. "I don't really care if someone believes in some pie-in-the-sky notion of equality in theory. We fought alongside Stalin's army in the war, after all. But no, this was more than water cooler talk. He went to meetings. He distributed literature."
"How'd you find out?"
"Jackass handed a brochure to one of our clients who recognized him from a pitch meeting."
"Pitch meeting?" asked Charlie.
"Yes," said LaMontagne. "This wasn't the guy who pushed the pastry cart. This was one of our main guys in R&D.
"Working on what, if you don't mind my asking?"
"I really need you to keep this between us, Charlie."
"Of course."
"Surveillance technology,"
LaMontagne confided.
"It has commercial applications, but the research is much more for the Pentagon and Central Intelligence."
"Commercial applications?"
"They're called baby monitors," LaMontagne said. "Zenith invented them after the Lindbergh baby's kidnapping. A few years ago, they introduced the radio nurse. When your baby's born, you and the missus will be able to sit in the living room while the sounds of your baby are piped in from his bedroom."
"One way, so the baby doesn't hear you?" Charlie said.
"Right. A good idea, but the ones in the stores right now are clunky, and the reception is awful. The signal is sent through your own electrical wiring in your home, so signals get crossed, and you might all of a sudden pick up the latest Senators game. Plus, they're pricey, like $20 each, so they're not exactly flying off the shelves. But we have a good model that's about to hit the stores. I'll get you one.
No need, but forget the commercial application. You want Central Intelligence to buy this baby monitor technology for what? Listening devices at the Soviet embassy? He'd meant it as a joke, but as soon as he said it, he realized it actually made sense.
Bingo, said LaMontagne, and he landed an elegant forefinger on his nose in approval. But we didn't trust that the communist leaflet guy, Boschwitz, that's his name, Ira Boschwitz, wasn't going to tip off his ideological brethren at the embassy. Or, even worse, give them the blueprints. So we fired him.
And how can I help?
Well, believe it or not, LaMontagne said, stubbing out his cigarette, Zenith hired him.
And McCarthy's holding hearings right now on the Army Signal Corps.
That's why I'm in town. They're going after Leo Kantrowitz today. Zenith fired him as soon as he got subpoenaed.
Charlie had read in the morning paper, indubitably leaked by McCarthy's chief counsel, Roy Cohn, that prior to Zenith, Kantrowitz had done classified work for the Army Signal Corps while he was a member of the Communist Party.
But Kantrowitz is small potatoes, LaMontagne said. They're missing the real problem.
Boschwitz?
Boschwitz.
Why haven't you just gone right to the committee? I'm sure they'd be interested in hearing this. LaMontagne lit another Chesterfield.
Our in-house counsel advised us against direct coordination. We've attempted other avenues, but so far members of the committee have thought we were just bad-mouthing a competitor. Also, we didn't have any evidence other than anecdotal.
He withdrew a manila folder from his briefcase and tossed it onto the coffee table in front of Charlie, who picked it up but didn't open it. Are you just bad-mouthing a competitor? Is the fact that he went to Zenith a big part of this? LaMontagne stood.
Just open the folder. Anything you could do to pass it on to Cohn or Bob Kennedy would be very deeply appreciated.
He looked at his watch.
But I gotta run. Have a thing with Dulles in an hour.
John Foster or Allen? Charlie asked, as he had to wonder why a mid-level electronics executive would be meeting with either the Secretary of State or the Director of Central Intelligence, both of whom quietly wove their tentacles around anything and everything that could be construed as being in the national security interests of the United States.
Does it matter?
LaMontagne asked. He grabbed his hat and jacket from the coat rack and nearly bumped into Sherrilyn Bernstein on his way out the door. She smiled at him brightly. Charlie sometimes wondered if there was any encounter that wouldn't prompt that cheerful Midwestern smile, and stood aside to let him pass. Bernstein reminded Charlie of many of the Barnard students he'd taught. Bright, eager, wide-eyed, and, though he'd be loath to make such an observation aloud, a touch flirtatious, very mildly, like a teenager permitted to apply only some modest lipstick, her coy glances almost like a risque outfit she was trying on in the store just to see how it felt. Not that there was anything particularly sensual about the bond they were forming, which was rooted in intellectual pursuits more than anything else, but he would be lying if he pretended that being around a woman who seemed delighted to be talking to him wasn't a welcome change. He knew this was the emotional equivalent of a Hershey bar, but that didn't make it taste any less sweet. She held a folder aloft like a trophy she'd just won. Do you remember that scrap of paper you told me to look into, Congressman? It's taken me a few weeks, but I have some possible leads. Charlie motioned her to a seat and silently mourned the loss of the productive early morning he'd planned. He would have been inclined to forget about those cryptic scribbles. U Chicago, 2, 4D, 2, 4, 5T, cereal grains, broadleaf crops. She provided her update. After he'd handed her the weird note while they were getting off the Senate subway, she'd cold called the University of Chicago's Department of Botany, and the department librarian had said she'd look into it. She was so helpful when we first spoke, and she even said she had a good idea about where to look for more information. But since then, Bernstein paused dramatically, and Charlie stifled a small sigh of impatience while he glanced at his watch. I've been calling and calling, and she has not taken my call for almost a month now. Odd, said Charlie, though he couldn't help wondering if a departmental librarian had more pressing duties to attend to than chasing down a stranger's out-of-left-field requests. I know, Bernstein enthused, her excitement suddenly bubbling over. But then I had another idea. My brother goes to Northwestern, so I asked him to stop by the department and see what he could find out. She paused again.
He's pretty handsome, and the librarian was very friendly to him until he revealed why he was there. He said she got really cold, really fast. Said the study he was asking about was subject to wartime secrecy laws, and that there was nothing that could be shared with the public in any way. And she had campus security escort him out.
Charlie sat up a little straighter now. Maybe this wild goose chase wasn't so wild after all. Were you able to get any information about the study, the name of the professors?
Yes, Bernstein said, leafing through her stenopad. Krauss and Mitchell.
Okay, Charlie said, writing down their names. I guess the next step would be for me to ask about it at the Pentagon, or to get someone on the Armed Services Committee to do so.
What about Strongfellow?
Perfect. Leopold poked her head into the office. Cheryl Ann, you need to finish up that typing I gave you. And Congressman, you have just enough time to stop in and see Senator Kefauver before the morning vote, if you leave right now. Charlie didn't feel like taking the monorail to get to the Senate office building, the SOB, as everyone on the Hill called it. He wanted to stretch his legs. After making his way up to the second floor of the U.S. Capitol, he spotted Congressman Isaiah Street standing in National Statuary Hall, a semicircular room right off the House chamber featuring statues of notable Americans. Each of the 48 states had contributed two of the immense likenesses, with 36 standing in the room like soldiers in formation, curving along the wall of the Statuary Hall chamber. Dozens of others were scattered throughout other nearby rooms and halls. Charlie had seen Street every poker night, but seldom ran into him anywhere else. They had developed an easy rapport during the weekly games. Street stood glowering at one of the statues contributed by Georgia, the figure of former governor Alexander Stevens.
Charlie, he said, a smile stretching across his face, I have good news. Congressman Powell is going to vote however you want today, depending on whether the Goodstone provision has been removed.
Representative Adam Clayton Powell, Jr., Democrat of New York, was a member of the House Appropriations Committee. Street had offered to lobby Powell on Charlie's behalf to get his support on Goodstone.
Thank you, but I'm not sure I need it. I'm told it's gone.
Street looked confused.
Really? I thought I just read that General Kinetics was making a play to buy Goodstone. Blacklisting them will be bad for both companies and for the deal.
I hadn't heard that, Charlie said, stunned by the news. Learning that General Kinetics was attempting to purchase Goodstone was like finding out the Chinese were sending troops in to defend North Korea. Charlie pointed to a statue of Supreme Court Chief Justice Morrison Mott Waite, the image of regality, leaning on a cane. See how his forefingers are crossed on the handle of the cane? That's a sign he was a member of the Yale Secret Society's Skull and Bones. Street shook his head.
Folks at home, voters, would be amazed if they ever found out how many decisions are actually made by these secret societies and clubs.
Who else is there besides Skull and Bones? Charlie asked. The Masons? The Illuminati?
The Klan, Street said.
He motioned back toward the statue of Governor Stevens.
Quote, our new government's cornerstone rests upon the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man, he recited, that slavery, subordination to the superior race, is his natural and normal condition, unquote.
Charlie looked down at the statue's foundation, where the engraving read, I am afraid of nothing on the earth, above the earth, beneath the earth, except to do wrong.
Street shrugged. He said what I said, too. Vice President of the Confederacy. That's all you need to know.
To be fair, how many white men in Georgia opposed slavery in the 1860s, Charlie said. In his teaching days, he had always asked his students to consider the context of the era they studied.
The British outlawed slavery in 1833, Street countered.
George Washington had slaves. Do you want to change the name of this city?
Street pointed to a majestic bronze caped figure from Mississippi, Jefferson Davis.
President of the Confederacy, Street said. Why is it that almost 100 years later, society still hasn't labeled these men traitors?
I don't know, Charlie said. He was done playing devil's advocate on an issue where he actually did think of the clients as devils.
The good guys won, so to speak. So why are there statues of the bad guys? It's not as though the French have statues of their traitors from the war, the Vichy French.
That's not entirely true, Charlie said. Marshal Pétain died just a few years ago, and they have a bunch of streets named after him in France.
But that's not because he collaborated with the Nazis. It's despite the fact that he did, Street said. You know damn well it's because he was a hero in the Great War.
I'm just saying it's all more complicated than you're making it seem, Charlie said. De Gaulle led the Free French, but he placed a wreath on Pétain's tomb.
Street shoved his hands in his pockets and looked at the ceiling. He wasn't concealing his disgust. He was making it clear that refraining from voicing it was a struggle.
Forgive me, Charlie said. You know I'm an academic. Sometimes we get caught up in the abstract rather than the reality. These men contained multitudes. They did heinous, unforgivable things. Don't misunderstand me, but they're more than their misdeeds, right? FDR sent the Japanese to camps. Lincoln suspended habeas corpus. 12 U.S. presidents were slave owners, including the one who'd been the top general of the Union Army.
Street shook his head. I don't know, Charlie. John Adams knew better. John Quincy Adams knew better. Lincoln knew better. Right is right and wrong is wrong. You fought for your country, you married a good woman, you work hard to protect troops from future shitty gas masks. You're not betraying your principles. You don't contain multitudes.
He paused. Do you, Charlie?
Charlie, how are you? Senator Kefauver greeted him with his attention more focused on the Zenith television. Senator McCarthy was interrogating a witness.
I'm fine, sir. I need some advice, Charlie said. He had brought two things to the meeting. The Boschwitz dossier LaMontagne had given him, and Wortham's Seduction of the Innocent. He set both on the coffee table and sat in the chair in front of the senator's desk.
I've got... Kefauver held up a hand to hush Charlie and pointed toward the television console in the corner. Using a Lazybones remote control hooked up to the television by a wire, he turned up the volume.
Look, mister, I am not going to waste all afternoon with you, Senator Joseph McCarthy bellowed at a witness. I have asked you a very simple question. You will answer it, unless you want to take the Fifth Amendment. If you think it will incriminate you, you can take the Fifth Amendment.
Restate the question, said the witness. The hearing's reporter read back from her notes.
When you got this job working on Army Ordnance, do you know whether or not the man who hired you knew that you had been accused of communist activities prior to that time, she said.
The witness and his lawyers huddled in consultation.
I see you're reading Seduction of the Innocent, Kefauver noted.
It is amazing, the twisted things children are learning about murder and rape and torture. This is going to be a big hearing, Charlie.
On television, Senator McCarthy had now turned over the hearing to his chief counsel, Roy Cohn, who appeared to be eviscerating a new witness.
While you were attending Cornell, did you know a man named Alfred Sarant?
Cohn, a pit bull of a man, was clearly already in possession of the answer.
I refuse to answer that question on the grounds of the Fifth Amendment, said the witness.
Did Sarant recruit you into the Rosenberg spy ring?
I refuse to answer that question on the grounds of the Fifth Amendment.
Did you engage in a conspiracy to commit espionage with certain persons working for the Army Signal Corps?
I refuse to answer that question on the grounds of the Fifth Amendment.
Jesus, said Kefauver, standing. The Rosenbergs.
Did you ever visit Julius Rosenberg at the Emerson Electric Company and obtain from him material which you transmitted to a Soviet spy ring?
I refuse to answer that question on the grounds of the Fifth Amendment.
I mean, good Christ, Charlie.
Kefauver exhaled loudly, sank his bulky frame back down into his chair, and grabbed a cigar stub from his desk that he commenced chewing. His dull blue eyes ping-ponged between Charlie and the television.
So, speaking of McCarthy and the Army Signal Corps, Charlie said, an acquaintance of mine handed me a file on one of Zenith's guys, asked me to pass it on to Bob Kennedy or Cohn.
Kefauver looked as though he had just detected an unpleasant odor.
Yeah, that was my reaction too, said Charlie. Making matters worse, he's with a direct competitor of Zenith.
Oh, Lordy, said Kefauver.
But what happens if I don't hand the information over and it's real?
Or even if it's not real, but McCarthy leaks to his stooges in the press that you refuse to inform the committee about a commie, Kefauver said.
You've got to worry about these things now. We all do. McCarthyism is a cancer, and it won't just be an election you don't win.
Kefauver warmed to his topic with alarming speed.
You'll be ruined. Columbia won't let you back. You'll end up teaching at Barnyard High in East Turtle Turd, Kentucky.
Charlie suddenly realized that until just now, he had regarded his new life in Washington almost as if it were a summer camp in the Catskills or a home of a college buddy he was visiting for a long weekend. Someplace he could parachute into and soon leave with
no impact on his real life. But he knew Kefauver was right. Columbia would invoke the standard clause about bringing shame and embarrassment to the university community. His publishing house would stop returning his phone calls.